This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. After the July 4th recess, Congress is back in session today with Iraq once again at the top of the agenda. Some Senate Democrats are expected to propose timetables for withdrawal as part of the defense authorization bill. The White House and many Senate Republicans oppose any measure that, as they describe it, would cut off funds to support troops in the field. But what policies do current and former members of the military support? The Washington Monthly magazine solicited essays from veterans of the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan and asked them to consider the question in terms of the next presidential election. We'll talk with three of those veterans about which policies, which party, and which candidate might win their votes. And we want to hear from vets and active service military in our audience as well. Would you vote for a party, a policy, or a particular candidate, and why? Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. Email talk@npr.org. You can also comment on our blog. That's at npr.org/blogofthenation. Later, the decline and fall of the great American nickname on the opinion page this week. Why in the land of the splendid splinter has the moniker moved to mediocrity, and the funeral of a superhero? But first, military voices on Iraq and next year's presidential election. We begin with Nathaniel Fick. He served as a Marine infantry officer in Afghanistan and Iraq. He's written about his combat experience in his book, One Bullet Away. Nathaniel Fick joins us from the studios of member station WBUR in Boston. Nice to have you on the program today.
It's a pleasure, Neil. Thank you.
And in your essay, you did not put Iraq at the top of your agenda, or at least not in so many words.
Well, I didn't. I don't think a lot of vets are one-issue voters, even on something as important as Iraq. And the number one issue on my agenda, Neil, was public service. It's been most shocking to me in the last 5 or 6 years that we haven't heard a call to national service of any kind. Instead, Americans have essentially been told to keep shopping.
And have any of the candidates or either of the big political parties addressed that concern in your mind?
I don't think they have. We see them nibbling around the edges, but instead we tend to vacillate between the two extremes of either just implying that people go on with their lives or talking about what I see as more radical positions such as a draft. I'm not prepared to coerce people to serve until we first ask them to serve.
And what do you mean by national service?
Well, nothing mandatory initially, Neil. I think that we should use the bully pulpit of public life to ask young Americans to get involved. John F. Kennedy famously said, "Ask not what your country can do for you, but what you can do for your country." And we haven't heard that. In my experience with my peers in college, my peers in the Marines, young people are willing to serve today, but no one has come forward to ask.
Or propose a method for them to do so.
Well, that's right. It's also extremely hard. You look at college campuses, and big American companies have a very visible recruiting process. With a clear and easy way of getting a job. Mm-hmm. But the government is seen as convoluted and slow, a lot of red tape and bureaucracy. It's not an appealing job process, and I think we have to reform the process in order to help attract more and better people.
You also talk about you'll vote for somebody who makes explicit the three-way relationship between energy, the environment, and national security.
It's appalling to me that these issues seem to be the provinces of the far left in terms of the environment and the far right in terms of national security, when instead they're sort of an iron triangle. The three come together, and in my mind, environmental change poses security challenges of enormous magnitude, mm-hmm. And our energy dependence constricts our strategic options. So these are interrelated issues, and the change is happening. We can either lead it or we can be shaped by it.
And again, has either of the parties or any of the candidates that you'd heard of addressed those issues directly?
Not directly, not with any sort of comprehensive plan. Now, granted, it's very early in the mm-hmm. campaign, but I'm not ready to put my chips on any one horse at this point.
Mm-hmm. And there is one and only one threat, you note, that could change life as we know it an hour from now, and that's nuclear weapons. Again, loose nukes, the issue of nuclear proliferation into states and perhaps even into non-state actors such as terrorists, these are very important issues. You put it number three.
Well, there was a global sigh of relief, I think, at the end of the Cold War, and then we've squandered almost a decade and a half since then with fissile material moving around the globe, virtually untracked and untrackable, the development or the emergence of new nuclear states. And there's general consensus, I think, among many experts that there's a greater risk of a nuclear detonation in the next 10 years than there was during, say, any given 10 years of the Cold War. And I think that's a terrifying thought, but it's so far beyond the pale, it's almost so hard to think about that it's easy just for us not to even see it on the list of issues.
And fourth is Iraq, and we'll get to that in just a moment. I wonder, of the men and women with whom you served, would you say that those are their issues too?
I can't claim to speak for anyone but myself, Neil, but I do think that there's, as part of the almost the democratization of media in this country, the 24-hour news cycle maybe changes generationally. You do see young soldiers and Marines who are more and more politically attuned. Now, there's a tradition of professional apoliticism in the U.S. military that's sacred, and many senior military officers famously don't even vote or never say who they're voting for. I think that's a good thing. We don't want the people with the guns to have a political voice in this country, but people are aware and people are thinking, and so I do think that the next election very much leaves the military vote up for grabs.
You talk, though, about a sort of an apolitical tradition. Nevertheless, the military vote and the veteran vote, too, long seen as very much pro-Republican.
Yeah, I think they are. And, you know, I hesitate even though to cast it as a monolith like that. But given the policies of the last few years, I think now more than ever, many of my friends and comrades I serve with are waiting to see what policies are advanced, and they're much more inclined now to vote a policy than they are to vote a party.
More pragmatic than ideological.
I think so, yes.
And then we get to Iraq, and what are the pragmatic policies you would like to see pursued in Iraq? And again, do any of the parties, any of the candidates, speak to them?
Well, my personal opinion is that the United States can no longer win in Iraq, as we have been defining winning for the last few years. But that doesn't mean we don't have enduring national interests there. And I would name at least three. I think we have a national interest, if you want to say a moral obligation, in preventing genocide. Second, I think we have a national interest in doing what we can to prevent regional war. And third, I think we have a very clear interest in preventing the emergence of a safe haven, another failed state where non-state actors can train and plan operations that can reach out and hurt us. So we have to strike some middle ground between recognizing that our initial goals are probably not attainable, and recognizing that we do have these interests that we need to do our best to secure.
And again, which party, which candidates?
I think that we clearly need to change course. We need to withdraw a very large number of forces from Iraq. We simply can't sustain the personnel commitment that we have on the ground right now. The wheels come off the personnel system at some point in the next 6 to 12 months. Mm. And you see it with Army tours being extended to 15 months. My Marine buddies at this point are doing 7 months in Iraq, seven in the States, repeatedly, again and again. And with an all-volunteer force that tends to be older, it tends to be more married, it tends to have more children, you can't do that indefinitely. People reach the breaking point.
And news today, the Army has failed to reach its recruiting goals for the second month in a row. But we want to hear from listeners as well. We're talking with Nate Fick, a former Marine infantry officer in Iraq and Afghanistan. We're asking about military votes. We want to hear from current active duty military and from veterans of those wars as well. Give us a call, 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Email us, talk@npr.org. And let's begin with Larry. Larry's calling us from Middleville in Michigan. And Larry, we're having a hard time hearing you over that phone line. And I'm afraid I'm going to have to let you go. Please try us again, Larry. Let's try instead John. And John's with us from Charlotte, North Carolina.
My opinion on this is I don't like the term win. We won what we were supposed to win. We ousted Saddam Hussein. Mm-hmm. It's not our war to win anymore. It's our job to let the Iraqi government form and do for itself. You pull out now, you're just going to create a state where it's total chaos, where the terrorists will have a complete opportunity to do whatever they want.
So would you support the candidate or the party that keeps a large number of American forces in Iraq until such time as those conditions are obtained?
I think it needs to be a twofold purpose, and I can't determine, you know, what the number of soldiers need to be or number of personnel, but some pressure needs to be applied to the Iraqi government to move forward faster, at the same time withdrawing our troops to come home. But it has to be a balancing act, because if you pull out too fast, the nation will fall. And I did this. The ideology that this is a winnable battle or winnable anything is far past. We won. We ousted Saddam Hussein. Now it's not a job for us to win anymore. It's our job to provide support for these people so they can rebuild their nation and make it what it's supposed to be.
And you still think that goal is still achievable?
Yeah. I mean, if you pull out now, no, it's completely not achievable. Let's just pull all of our personnel and bring them home. No, then it's definitely not achievable. But it, in the long run, yes, it's still achievable. I mean, the numbers say, in the past, since February, with the increased number of troops, the percentage of violence has dropped.
It has dropped in certainly in and around Baghdad and certain other areas where military operations are underway, yes.
And the other thing that bothers me about this is that all we hear about on the news is the bad things. We hear about 9 troops getting killed over the weekend. Yes, that is a horrible thing, but we never hear about the good stories. You never speak. There's never any interviews of the airmen, the soldiers, the sailors over there, and the good things that they do. All we hear about the negatives.
All right, John. Thanks very much for the call. Appreciate it.
All right.
And I wonder what you make of that, Nate.
Well, if we're going to argue that we won by ousting Saddam Hussein, I would argue that that's the ultimate Pyrrhic victory, and that it is incredibly short-sighted for the U.S. to go to war simply to topple people. If we're not going to create a better reality, political reality in its wake. So I think toppling Saddam Hussein may have been necessary but not sufficient, and I'm totally unwilling to draw the line of victory at that point. I agree with the caller that we have to put pressure on the Iraqi government. I think we've been unsuccessful thus far in doing that, and at this point, maybe the best pressure we can apply is a credible threat of withdrawal.
Is a credible threat of withdrawal reach these goals by such and such a date or else?
I did not support a date for withdrawal for a long time, and the military talks about event-driven timelines rather than calendar-driven timelines. So being raised in that culture, I was viscerally opposed to a date. The Commandant of the Marine Corps, General P.X. Kelly, famously testified talking about withdrawing troops from Lebanon in the 80s, if you set a date and the time is too short, our enemies will wait us out. If it's too long, they'll drive us out. At this point, though, I'm afraid we have to choose among bad options.
Nate Fick, thanks very much for being with us today.
Thank you.
Nathaniel Fick served as a Marine infantry officer in Iraq and Afghanistan. He's the author of the bestseller One Bullet Away. Joined us today from our member station in Boston, WBUR. More after a break. I'm Neil Conan. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. A little bit later, we'll get to the opinion page and the downfall of the great American nickname. How do we go from Mr. October to I-Rod? We'll get to that a little later. Right now, we're talking with military veterans and active service personnel about next year's presidential election. If you're a veteran of Iraq or Afghanistan, let us know what it would take to get your vote. Would you vote for a party, a policy, or a particular candidate, and why? 800-989-8255. Email talk@npr.org. You can join in on the blog as well. That's at npr.org/blogofthenation. And joining us now from Chicago is Clint Douglas, who served in Afghanistan in 2003 as a staff sergeant in the 20th Special Forces Group. Nice to have you on the program today.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
And you wrote in your piece that was published in the Washington Monthly, that there's almost a visceral response to Democrats, at least among many of the soldiers you served with. Why would they vote Republican, you ask? Because Democrats are a bunch of wusses, not the word you used.
Yeah, the piece I wrote was pretty polemical. But it was for a reason. I think that liberals, I think that the Democratic Party post-Vietnam has largely abdicated on issues of national defense. And I think that it's become the sole territory of the political right in our society. And I don't see any reason for it at all.
Mm-hmm. And nevertheless, there seems to be this fundamental belief amongst many in the military that their lives are better under Republicans and indeed that the country has policies that they can feel better about among Republicans.
Yeah, I agree. The one difference now, though, is that with this disaster in Iraq, I think that we could see a political sea change. I think that the Democrats are finding how to use the rhetoric, and the rhetoric is important. It's important how you present yourself to start to take back some of those national defense, veteran, and military votes that have been, I think, fundamentally betrayed by this administration.
And you also suggest that when the legions return from Iraq and Afghanistan and start asking questions, they're going to be awfully angry.
I think that they will be angry. I mean, that's what we saw in Vietnam. A lot of these people were sidelined in within our society. And now, but the difference this time around is that this is a professional military that are very well educated comparatively.
Mm-hmm.
And they're going to come back, and they're going to want to sit at the table, and they're going to demand, I think, redress. And I think it's important to anticipate that.
And so far, have you heard Democratic candidates, the Democratic Party in general, addressing these issues in the way that will resonate with you and other members of the military?
To a certain extent, I'm supporting Barack Obama. I think that we need leadership that has foresight and vision. And I'm not paid by the campaign or anything.
Okay.
I'm not a political hacker. But I think it's important to remember who called Iraq right early. And I think that people who did not, we need to hold them to account for their previous votes and their actions on both parties, particularly within the administration and amongst other candidates as well.
As I understand the senator's position, though, he's calling for a withdrawal that might lead some people to charge that those who died in the past 6 years or so, that his policy would waste those lives.
You know, that's the thing. It's heartbreaking. Like, I served in Afghanistan, and I totally sympathize with the Iraqi veterans who have killed people, who have been wounded, who've seen their buddies get blown apart. I mean, that soil, to a certain extent, is sacred. But you can't justify a continuing conflict by only feeding more blood on top of blood. My own position, like in Afghanistan, if we were going to pull out of Afghanistan, I would tear my hair out in clumps. But again, I think that we have a right moral fight in Afghanistan. I don't think we have that in Iraq anymore. And I don't think that we can win in Iraq. Hmm. In Afghanistan, from my own personal experience, there's still such a well of goodwill towards Americans, towards the United States. So many Afghans, Pashtun, Tajik, and otherwise, remember us as the people who supported them in the jihad against the Soviets. We have failed to tap into that. And now, candidly, we're looking at a possible defeat in Afghanistan.
Hmm. Let's get some more listeners on the line. Again, our number, if you'd like to join us, is 800-989-8255. Email is talk@npr.org. We're talking right now with Clint Douglas, a former staff sergeant with the 20th Special Forces Group who served in Afghanistan in 2003. Brian joins us on the line. Brian's in Augusta, Georgia.
Thank you very much, Neil. I just want to say that I was listening to the last speaker you had, the colonel, and now the current one. And I think really the issue that I have as a two-time Iraqi vet, and I'm getting ready to go back over the Persian Gulf in support of soldiers on the ground there. I think the issue is that we have no plan. There's nothing been solidified. And I think right now with the current 2008 campaign, the way it's going, that no one has said something definitive, or if they've said something, there's been nobody really supporting them to back them up. And I think what becomes very frustrating and is the fact that we are very proud to serve there. As a soldier, as sailors, as Marines collectively, we are proud to serve our country and to go out and do the missions we've been assigned to do. But there comes a point where you don't know anymore. You don't know who have faith in. And I traditionally, I'm a Democrat, and it's ironic because the Republicans are the ones that are, you know, supporting the military. And now even I don't know who's in the right now, and I think I'm very undecided at this point as far as who I'm voting for in 2008. And I think it has come down to a choice of policy over party or candidate.
A choice of policy over party or candidate, and obviously between now and then there's still considerable time. Those policies may become more clear.
Absolutely.
And you're going back for a third tour?
Yes, not in Iraq. I'll be supporting troops in the Persian Gulf.
Well, you take care of yourself.
Thank you very much, Neil.
Appreciate it, Brian. It's interesting, our earlier guest, Nate Fick, also raised this point. In terms of national sacrifice, it's a point you raise in your essay in the Atlantic Monthly as well.
Right. I mean, so far, all of these wars have been really carried on the shoulders of, what, maybe 1% of the population, people in the military and their dependents. I don't think that the rest of the society really has an inkling of what's going on. And this administration has failed to articulate this war in clear language that people can understand. And by starting this war in Iraq, which was a war of choice, it has been so divisive within our society that any kind of consensus currently, and probably for at least another year or so, it seems very difficult to find.
And would you hope to at least arrive at some sort of consensus in terms of that national election, that whoever wins, that'll be the policy the nation can rally behind?
We can only hope. It's unclear. Some people seem to think that our society is very divided. I disagree. I think that radical center is still out there, and I just don't think that it's been really appropriately addressed or courted.
Let's see if we get another caller on the line, and let's go to Jeff, and Jeff's with us from Chittenango in New York.
Hi, thanks for taking the call.
Sure.
Great discussion today, and I'm enjoying it very much.
Thank you.
I want to pick up on the thread that you just mentioned about the not asking for sacrifice. One thing that Senator McCain said in the last couple of years, I think, is quite articulate and apt, and that is, in previous wars, people were called on to make sacrifices. Look at World War II, war bond drives, or people working hard in factories to support the war effort. And President George W. Bush really hasn't called on people to sacrifice. I think he learned a lesson from George H.W. Bush, who fought a very successful military campaign, and then because there was a little dip in the economy, that's just just the way cycles go, the American people tossed him out on his butt. And I think George W. Bush, his lesson he took away from that was, I have to have tax cuts because they do stimulate the economy. I think every expert would now agree that tax cuts do stimulate the economy.
Oh, well, you can't quote all the experts on anything, but go ahead.
and it does that. But I think he's short-sighted in that we're still spending something like 3% of gross domestic product in the middle of a war. It's producing what the Marine you had on earlier, who I also find quite articulate, said, in that you can only take a volunteer force and push them 7 months on, 7 months off, or 15 months for soldiers and then a short time off for so long. And the answer Senator McCain, I think, is saying is, if we increase the percentage of our GDP that went toward the military, we could expand the force. The 92,000 additional soldiers and Marines, it's a good step, but it's several years too late, and it's not far enough. Mm. So that's my thought there. And I would like to discuss more about the strategic centers of gravity that Marine also spoke about, if that's okay with you, Neil.
Go ahead.
Well, I think he was very apt when he says that there's this iron triangle between the environment and the other issues. And
energy and
thing, yeah. I'm sorry?
Energy and national security policy were the other two, yes.
Exactly. There's an iron triangle also between the events on the ground in Iraq and Afghanistan. And then the third one that's not linked in is Israel. And I think that there's a lot of hatred in the Arab world for America, and there has been really since 67 at the very latest. And I think that the most of the Arab world, and I've deployed to Afghanistan most recently in 2002. I flew several deployments in the mid-90s to fly sorties over Iraq, and I've spoken to many Muslims. And my impression is that there's a very deep and an abiding hatred of Jews in general. And I think that they are keenly aware that but for the United States checking the Soviet Union in 67 and again in 73, they would have been able to exterminate Israel. And I share no illusions that their objectives of a large portion of Arab society is anything short of that. So the hatred is there for America. It was there on 9/11 before we had troops in Afghanistan, before we had troops on the ground in Iraq. So I think that Marine was quite articulate when he says, candidates need to talk about a broader view and bring things into play. And that's one thing, is that the Arab-Israeli conflict is fundamentally going to cause hatred of America. And unless we choose to abandon Israel and allow them to be exterminated, then they're going to hate us. So the choice is, do they hate us and think us strong, or do they hate us and think us weak? And Osama bin Laden, actually, in his declaration of war in the United States, I believe in 1996, he used the analogy of a horse, When people see a strong horse or a weak horse, they like the strong horse. The question now is America the strong horse or the weak horse? And if we cut and run like we did in Vietnam and allow genocide to happen, tens of thousands of Vietnamese were massacred when we left, the same thing will happen if we leave hastily from Iraq, if we leave hastily from Afghanistan. It's going to be pretty apparent to the Ummah, the Muslim people, who the strong horse is and the weak horse is. And his audience is the Ummah, and that is our key center of gravity, is the will of his of the Arab street. And I think that Senator McCain is one of his most articulated positions that I think would advance us toward where we need to be, because it's a long and enduring struggle, decades long. We need to have more taxes to fund the military, not tax cuts and only asking 1% of the society to serve. And thank you very much. I'll take my response off of you.
Okay, Jeff, thanks very much for the call. And I don't know if you wanted to come back on that, Clint Douglas.
Well, first of all, I don't think that the Israel is a nuclear-armed power. I don't think that they're going to allow anybody to annihilate them.
You might have something to say about that, yeah.
addressing the Ummah, you know, I guess that's another argument I would suggest in what I want to hear from a candidate or anybody else, is that I think getting our army out of Iraq where it is sitting and where they can be attacked, get them out, and then we can play to the Ummah and we can try and affect opinion both through strong and soft politics.
Thanks very much for being with us today.
My pleasure. Thank you for having
me. Clint Douglas served as a staff sergeant in Afghanistan in 2003. Joined us today from our bureau in New York. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And Garth Stewart joins us now. He was a mortar gunner in the 3rd Infantry Division in the 2003 invasion of Iraq. He's just finished his sophomore year at Columbia University. Nice to have you on the program today. He's at our bureau in New York.
Hey, thank you very much.
And you write in your essay in the Atlantic Monthly that you were initially against the Iraqi invasion, but changed your mind.
Yes, sir. I did change my mind.
And why was that?
Well, one, I served there. And so, I mean, of course, after I, you know, committed a certain amount of effort and time and blood and sweat into the venture, you know, I wanted to see it become successful. But, you know, the second part of that is, I don't know, since we've been there, now the Al-Qaeda's there. And, you know, we're still at war with them and we have to do something about it. So now that we're there and now that Al-Qaeda's there, I just think we should kind of stay and fight it out, if that makes any sense.
So having committed to this operation, you say we should not leave it until we have won? And how do you define victory?
I would define victory as a stable and successful democracy and a capitalist Iraq. I think that our invasion has a little bit to do with power structures in the Middle East existing that the West can't penetrate very easily. Mm-hmm. And I think this is kind of what? I mean, this is an attempt to change that. You know, after the Iranian Revolution, now if we go in and we make the Middle East, you know, a successful capitalist part of the world market, and if kids are playing, you know, PlayStation 2s instead of just receiving religious instruction, and you know, maybe we'll stop seeing terrorism, or maybe we'll stop seeing suicide bombers. I mean, I think that's what we have to win. I mean, maybe it's a chance to fix the Middle East. Now that we're there, now that we've already done the work to get our troops on the ground, maybe we can try to change the culture in a way that might make it more friendly to us as a nation.
All right, let's see if we can get another caller on the line. Johnny's with us. Johnny calling from Clarksville in Tennessee.
Yes, good evening. How you doing?
I'm well. Good afternoon.
Yeah, yes, sir. I'm on my way to the 101st for a third rotation in Iraq. 0506 was my last tour in Iraq, and I was with a 9-man team that was embedded in a Iraqi special police.
We're having a little trouble with your cell phone, Johnny.
Yes, can you hear me, sir?
Yeah, go ahead if you would.
Okay, yes, sir. Hey, this last rotation when I was in Iraq, I was part of a 9-man American team that was embedded in a Iraqi commando battalion.
Mm-hmm.
And just been listening to some of the guys, some of their comments. I'm active duty, 17 years in, Sergeant First Class. I mean, how many more times am I going over? October, November, possibly third rotation for 15 months this time. We have no goals, no common ground. The Iraqi population, by living with Iraqis this last time, nobody wants us there. It's just total chaos. I mean, there's nothing that we have done over the past 3 years that's bettered anything.
So it sounds like what you want to hear is a goal, what somebody plans to do.
Yes, sir. Give me a goal. Give me some common ground. Give me something that I can work forward to.
Well, how about this? All right, so we help kind of create and then sustain sectarian violence that so thoroughly destabilizes the country that by the time, you know, they're done killing themselves, they're ready to accept anything. And I guess that's when our plan starts revealing itself. And specifically with
Iraqis for 365 days minus the 15 days I was on R&R, and they're not going to protect themselves. They're not going to defend themselves.
No, that's kind of the plan. I think that's the plan.
To step up at the plate and say, I will defend.
Look, I think that's actually the plan. I think the sectarian violence is actually maybe something that we've created.
Sure.
And that, you know, it's just...
Well, Johnny, good luck. Thanks very much for the call.
Thank you.
And we'd like to thank Garth Stewart for his time today. He joined us from our bureau in New York. Nice to have you on the program, Garth.
Hey, my pleasure.
We're talking with vets who wrote articles in the Washington Monthly. I may have misidentified that publication earlier, and we thank them for their help in this. Coming up, the decline and fall of the nickname. Old Blue Eyes works. Pooty Poot, not so much. What famous nicknames come up a little short? 800-989-8255. Email talk@npr.org. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News.